Shanna E. Galyar. Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter. The court will be joined by Chief Judge Moore of the Court of Appeals. So let's give everyone a second to get in and out of the courtroom. Chief Judge Moore has now joined us in the courtroom, and with that, is it Ms. Hetker, I'm sorry. Ms. Hetker, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Counsel. May it please the court, I am Lori Hetcher, Assistant Public Defender out of Douglas County, Nebraska, and I represent Shanna Galyar for the purposes of this appeal. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you. Today, I request this court reverse Ms. Galyar's convictions for murder in the first degree and arson in the second degree. There are two grounds for reversal. First, as a matter of law, the state presented insufficient evidence to find Ms. Galyar guilty on either count. Second, Ms. Galyar received ineffective assistance of counsel at trial. Turning first to my insufficient evidence claim, over the course of a 10-day bench trial, the state presented a decent amount of evidence. However, the problem is the vast majority of that evidence had absolutely nothing to do with murder or arson. In fact, most of that evidence had to do with instances that occurred after Ms. Carrie Farver's disappearance. Most importantly, the state failed to provide any evidence, even taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, even resolving all inferences in favor of the state, as this court must do on appellate review, to show that any murder of Ms. Farver occurred purposely or with deliberate and premeditated malice. The state pointed to two pieces of physical evidence to show that Ms. Farver died: presence of a bloodstain in Ms. Farver's car and a photograph of a foot. The state also pointed to several pieces of evidence to link Ms. Galyar to this death: a supposed motive, a fingerprint, and what the state termed as a cover-up of Ms. Farver's disappearance. Now, first addressing the physical evidence, this bloodstain, which was found several years after Ms. Farver's disappearance, and I believe it was the third time the investigators examined the vehicle, found a bloodstain soaked into the passenger seat, on the seat of the car. Now, evidence at trial established that this bloodstain likely belonged to Ms. Farver. I believe the DNA showed that Ms. Farver was a likely contributor, highly statistically likely. However, as the state's expert testified, she did not have any evidence and had no way to determine when that bloodstain was left, the amount of blood necessary to leave such a bloodstain, or the type or location of injury that would have left such a bloodstain. All we know from this bloodstain is that at some point when Ms. Farver owned this car, she bled on the passenger seat. Similarly, the state pointed to a picture of a foot to establish...
Before you go on, what does the evidence tell us about how big the stain was?
Your Honor, there really wasn't much evidence at all. All we know is that the blood was soaked into the foam cushioning of the seat. The investigators did not find any blood on the seat cover. It apparently was enough to seep through that seat cover and into the cushion, but we don't know anything else about it. There just wasn't that evidence at trial.
Does the evidence tell us what kind of seat cover it was?
I do not recall. It's very possible there was a good amount of evidence regarding that seat cover. They may have mentioned the materials.
Thank you.
So turning to this photograph, there was a photograph of a foot. Evidence established that this was likely a picture of a left foot. There was also testimony that the tattoo on the foot in the picture was the same as or similar to a tattoo that the victim had on her left foot. Now, the medical testimony at trial established that there were marks on this foot that were consistent with a decomposing foot, consistent with a dead body. So what we know from this picture, taking the evidence in light most favorable to the state, is that likely this was a picture of a foot belonging to a deceased body, and that likely this was Carrie Farver's foot. That's all we know. From this picture, we know absolutely nothing about how Ms. Farver might have died.
Where was that photo found?
Yes.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor. That was going to be my next step. This photo was on an SD card found in a tablet. And now this tablet was in the possession and was owned by Mr. Dave Krupa. Dave Krupa was the romantic partner of Carrie Farber at the time of Ms. Farber's disappearance. He was also an on-again, off-again partner of Ms. Gallier. Now, testimony at trial established that Ms. Gallier may have had access to this tablet. However, the tablet did belong to Mr. Krupa. He testified there was no passcode on this tablet, but he kept it at his house. So the only inference is that Ms. Gallier may have been able to access this tablet. Now, I do believe there's also evidence that Ms. Gallier owned the SD card. There were some pictures on that SD card that were also found on other devices of Ms. Gallier's. However, it was a very small amount, I believe somewhere around 400 out of thousands of pictures. So there were also a good number of pictures on that SD card that were not linked to Ms. Gallier. So
the photo of the foot, was that contained in the 400 and some photos that were on Ms. Gallier's device?
No, Your Honor. The only place the state found this photo of a foot was on this SD card. It was not found on any other device known to be used or accessed by Ms. Gallier. So all we know from this foot, this picture, was that it may have been on a device that at some point Ms. Gallier may have accessed, and it was likely a picture of a dead foot. We do not know anything about how that foot came to be dead. We have no idea when that occurred.
What about Exhibits 551 through 563? I'm going to call them the confessions.
The confession emails? Yes, thank you, Your Honor. This falls within what the state viewed as the Ms. Gallier's cover-up of this murder. Now, these emails, what's important to note about them is that they were turned over to investigators after investigators interviewed Ms. Gallier and told her, we suspect Amy Flora, but we need something more. We need some sort of confession or statement from her that she knew about this death. Only after that did Ms. Gallier essentially give investigators open access to her emails. And then this email that was associated with an imposter account that was associated with Ms. Gallier sent one of Ms. Gallier's email accounts these confession emails. Now,
are you going to the weight of that evidence, or are you arguing that that should not be considered evidence at all?
No, I think this goes to the weight of that evidence. I think it's important background by which the court needs to consider these so-called confession emails, that the circumstances surrounding their creation were such that investigators essentially planted this idea in Ms. Gallier's head that they needed some sort of confession.
Was that a ruse by investigators?
I believe so. I believe at this point they did suspect Ms. Gallier. However, they did not have any direct evidence tying her to this, so they needed something more. And so Ms. Gallier, I believe, voluntarily spoke with investigators, and that's how this conversation happened. So these series of emails were written in the voice of Amy Flora, who again was a former partner of Dave Krupa. And these emails claimed that Amy Flora abducted Carrie Farber in Carrie Farber's own car. And the emails were gave several different methods of death. They were consistent in that they all said Amy Flora stabbed Carrie Farber in the car. However, they were unclear of the location of the stab wound. Some of the emails stated the stabbing happened in the chest or the stomach. And again, going back to that bloodstain was on the passenger seat of the car. So it's not really corroborated by that bloodstain, but that's what the email said. The emails were also inconsistent on how long it took Ms. Farber to die. I believe one of them stated Amy Flora dropped the car off in a Walmart parking lot for several days, returned to pick up the car, which somehow was still there with an alive body in it, and then took it to a secluded location to watch Ms. Farber die. So that was inconsistent whether the death occurred immediately or over the course of several days. The emails also gave several different methods of disposing the body. I believe one email stated that Amy Flora burned the body. Another one stated she cut up the body and then disposed of it. And a third stated that she shoved the body in a garbage bag and put that in a dumpster. So these so-called confession emails, really not a huge confession in my view.
Did they also contain information about the inside of the victim's home?
Yes.
Or things that weren't public information?
They did, Your Honor. The emails also claimed that, again, writing in the voice of Amy Flora, went to Ms. Farber's home after Ms. Farber's death to look in the home. And there were references to things in Ms. Farber's home in those emails.
And were there also references to a tarp that the body may have been placed in?
Yes, there. I believe in at least one of the emails. I don't remember if this was when the email that claimed that the body was burned or dumped in a garbage bin. But yes, one or at least one of the emails mentioned that the body was wrapped in a tarp.
And photographs contained, the photographs from the SD card we spoke about earlier contained photos of a tarp?
I believe so. I believe the testimony was that it likely was a tarp. Yes, you're correct.
Was there some evidence that Ms. Gallier was in the victim's home?
I believe the only evidence that Ms. Gallier was actually inside the home was in the so-called confession emails. The references to the furniture in Ms. Barber's home. There's some evidence that an imposter Facebook account prior to Ms. Barber's disappearance posted about being in Ms. Barber's hometown around the same time that Ms. Barber's car was vandalized. However, there are no witnesses placing Ms. Gallier in or near the home. There's some evidence that a phone number associated with Ms. Barber, which contacted Ms. Barber's mom after Ms. Barber's disappearance, saying, Shanna Gallier is going to come to my house. Please let her in. I sold her this furniture. However, that happened, I believe, several weeks after Ms. Barber's disappearance. There is no evidence, no testimony that Ms. Gallier was seen in Macedonia, Ms. Barber's hometown. No evidence that she was ever seen.
Was there a video recorder that was found?
Yes. So there was a video recorder and I believe a box of a tripod or the actual tripod that had been, there was receipts in Ms. Barber's possession that was later recovered in Ms. Gallier's possession. That's correct. So again, the bulk of this evidence goes toward this so-called cover-up. In the state's view, Ms. Gallier impersonated Ms. Barber online in order to show the world that Ms. Barber was actually not dead. The state also presented evidence Ms. Gallier impersonated other people online. There's evidence that she sent emails in the voice of Todd Butterbaugh, who was her sometimes romantic partner, Amy Flora, other women, and other fictional individuals as well. And there's no indication at trial that these individuals were dead. So just because Ms. Gallier was affiliated with messages that were sent impersonating Ms. Barber does not mean that she had anything to do with Ms. Barber's death or disappearance. Other state appellate courts have handled this question of how do we prove premeditation in these types of facts where we don't know the circumstances, and they have held that there is insufficient evidence of premeditation. Kirkland v. State of Florida found, the Supreme Court of Florida found that there was no premeditation, even when there was a body. In this case, several hours after death, family members found a body with a deep, irregular wound to the neck, so a wound that consistent with some type of murder. And as evidence that the defendant had motive, they was in a fight or potentially arguing with the victim, and that the defendant attempted to cover up by fleeing and was found several states away. However, the Supreme Court of Florida found there was no evidence of premeditation because there was no evidence of an intent to kill, no witnesses to the event immediately preceding, no evidence the defendant had a weapon or had access to a weapon.
Are there Nebraska cases that talk about missing body?
There are, Your Honor. State v. Edwards from 2009 does deal with the corpus delicti, proving for murder when there's a no body. In that case, the victims, this court held that because the victim's habits and routines had abruptly ceased and the victim was never heard from again, and because there was a crime scene with a significant amount of blood that the state's expert was able to testify was consistent with a murder. I believe the state's expert there called the blood stain a saturation stain. There was blood spatter on the walls that was consistent with swings of an individual weapon, like a sword that ended up being the weapon. I actually believe that the weapon was found. In that case, this court held that the corpus delicti was shown. I believe that's distinguishable from this case, even though the state did show that Ms. Farber's habits and routines did abruptly cease. She never contacted her son again, didn't attend the funeral of her father. However, we don't have that addition of the crime scene. All we have is again, that blood stain on the passenger seat that we don't know how much blood was left or the type of wound that was required to leave such a stain.
We also have the picture of the foot, though, don't we?
Again, we have the picture of the foot, which again would support, goes to the state's claim that Ms. Farber is dead.
However, that does not show us that that death was due to the criminal act of another, because we don't know from the state's own witness, we have no way to know how that death occurred.
One more question about the photos. I'm sorry, I keep coming back to those. They're not dated, are they? The ones that were on the SD card showing the foot and the tarp?
From my recollection, there was no evidence of a date introduced at trial. I could be wrong about that. So. Most importantly, the state of Washington recently addressed a case with almost eerily similar facts in Washington v. Hummel. There, the Washington Court of Appeals held that there was no evidence of premeditation. Now, in that case, the victim completely disappeared. She was never heard from again. Hummel, who was the victim's ex-husband, fraudulently obtained the victim's disability payments and also wrote cards and letters to their children impersonating the victim. So in the state's view, a state of Washington's view, this was Hummel attempting to cover up the victim's death and disappearance. In that case, Hummel also sent a letter to detectives investigating the case claiming that he disposed of the body after the victim committed suicide. Evidence at trial showed that any death was inconsistent with suicide, and also that Hummel had a significant motive, that the Hummel's daughter may have disclosed to the victim that Hummel was molesting her shortly prior to the victim's disappearance. There, the state held that all this evidence was evidence that Hummel was probably guilty of something, but what that something was not premeditated murder. Here we have the very, very similar facts. The state presented motive, that Ms. Gollier desired Ms. Farber's boyfriend. The state presented that Ms. Gollier likely impersonated Ms. Farber online. The state presented evidence that Ms. Gollier provided information to the detectives surrounding the manner and method of disappearance. However, none of that evidence goes to show anything about intent or malice. We have a huge gap here in the timeline. We have things that led up to Ms. Farber's disappearance, then a gap, and then we have things that happened after Ms. Farber's disappearance. That gap is when any premeditation or any intent occurred. And without any evidence around those circumstances, we just cannot know whether any death of Ms. Farber occurred purposely or with deliberate and premeditated.
Is there evidence of a motive? And how does motive relate to intent or malice?
So motive is circumstantial evidence of intent. It does go towards intent. However, here we do not have any evidence that motive or that Ms. Gollier desired to kill Ms. Farber. We have evidence that Ms. Gollier may have disliked Ms. Farber, that she may have desired Ms. Farber's boyfriend, but we have no statements that Ms. Gollier wanted Ms. Farber dead or wanted to harm Ms. Farber. Therefore, that motive, there wasn't any motive to kill Ms. Farber. There was motive to dislike her. And if this court doesn't have any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Before you sit down, you are not contesting that it was Ms. Gollier who authored those confessional emails.
I believe by the evidence the state presented at trial, taking it in the light most favorable to the state, as we must do on appeal, that yes, that is what that evidence showed.
Thank you.
One more before you sit down. If those emails are written by Ms. Gollier, particularly the ones in the voice of Ms. Flora,
yes.
and we know that at that point the police had asked for, we need evidence of a confession, couldn't the jury conclude that Ms. Gollier was doing her best to pin this crime on Ms. Flora by putting specific details of the act that only the person that committed the act would know? Why couldn't the jury reach that conclusion?
This was a bench trial, so there was
or
no
I,
jury.
I apologize,
yeah, no,
yeah.
Fine. And in that case, I believe that's probably the evidence the judge did reach, or the conclusion the judge did reach. However, I think that's a pretty big leap under the circumstances. I think all those emails show is that Ms. Gollier wanted to pin this on Ms. Flora. There wasn't enough in those emails to show that Ms. Gollier knew how Ms. Farber died. There wasn't enough evidence in those emails to show any intent or malice either.
Thank you.
I think I'd like to reserve the remaining amount of time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Marfisi, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Sarah Marfisi, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. The record in this case contains overwhelming circumstantial evidence that Shanna Gollier stabbed Carrie Farber to death in Carrie's car, and then spent years impersonating Carrie in order to remove a romantic rival, cover up the death, and secure Dave Krupa's affections. I'd like to begin by addressing appellant's sufficiency of the evidence argument with respect to the murder and arson, and as time allows, I'll briefly address the ineffective assistance of counsel claims as well. Beginning with the appellant's sufficiency evidence, I'd like to briefly address an issue from the briefs that did not come up in oral argument. The appellant's sufficiency of the evidence claim in her brief cites to the 1980 case State versus Payne with the accused's rule and argues that the state has to show, can only support this conviction with circumstantial evidence if that evidence is inconsistent with any reasonable hypothesis of innocence. This court has overruled that rule in 1981, recently in 2016 in State versus Ulbricht. So I want to make clear that the state does not have to disprove every hypothesis of innocence in order to support this claim with circumstantial evidence. Here, the evidence in the record does support the district court's judgment. The evidence shows that Gollier met the victim, Carrie, a few weeks before Carrie disappeared in 2012, when both women were dating the same man, Dave Krupa. On November 12, 2012, Carrie suddenly disappeared after spending the night with Dave. She did not appear for work on November 12th. She did not pick up her son from her mother's house. Her vehicle disappeared and was reported stolen. She stopped using the considerable funds in her bank account except for a few transactions right after her death that were flagged as suspicious. And nobody saw her or heard her voice again. As in State versus Edwards, this is sufficient evidence for a finder of fact to determine that she was murdered on the morning of November 12th. However, police did not immediately open homicide investigation because the defendant, Shanna Gollier, created numerous social media, email, and text accounts and used them to impersonate Carrie and make it appear that Carrie had absconded and was harassing Gollier and Dave Krupa. So when police first contacted Gollier after Carrie's disappearance, Gollier said, explained the check that she had written out trying to get access to Carrie's home by telling police that Carrie had actually broken into her house, had graffitied her garage, and that here she had a text taking responsibility from it. And so that began the impersonation, and this continued for years. And the state was able to connect all of these various impersonation text accounts, email accounts, to Gollier using IP addresses and remnants found on Gollier's electronic devices. In addition to this impersonation, which encompassed the arson and that I'll return to later, there was significant physical evidence connecting Gollier to Carrie's death. Just to highlight some of the evidence, Gollier applied for Carrie's job before a missing person report had been filed. Gollier had no reason to know that Carrie was missing or that a text from Carrie's phone had resigned from her job. There's a shower curtain. In the days after Carrie's disappearance, Carrie's debit card was used at a Walmart store near Gollier's house to purchase a black and white floral shower curtain. And the exact same shower curtain was later found in Gollier's house during execution of a search warrant. Additionally, video cameras and digital cameras that belonged to Carrie and had images Carrie had taken were found in Gollier's house during execution of a search warrant. And that was evidence that Gollier had been inside of Carrie's house. There's also evidence that Gollier had looked at Carrie's medications and used that in part of the cover-up. That was also evidence that Gollier had been inside Carrie's house. Moving to the electronic images, law enforcement uncovered a photograph of Carrie's car on Gollier's phone, and this was timestamped during the period of time after Carrie's disappearance and before the car was discovered in January 2013. There was no reason for Gollier to be taking photographs of Carrie's vehicle while it was disappeared. Additionally, on the SD card that Gollier had access to, that there was evidence that this SD card had previously been inserted into Gollier's phone. Police or IT professionals uncovered images of a decomposing left foot with the Chinese symbol for mother tattooed on it, and which was the same tattoo that Carrie had on her left foot. And the phone also contained zoomed-in images of a body part with the same yin-yang tattoo that Carrie had on her left hip. And additionally, images...
Well, how ultimately do you get...
Sure.
let's assume there was a murder. How do you get to the degree of murder? How do you get to first-degree murder or second-degree murder or manslaughter, for that matter?
Yes, Your Honor. So the confession emails are the best evidence of premeditation because they show the manner of killing. So as in the State versus Escamilla, I believe it's evidence of motive and evidence of manner of killing that are sufficient to show premeditation here. The confession emails, they're written in a third voice, but taking them in the light most favorable to the state, these are Gallier's own words, and they describe a premeditated manner of death. Numerous emails consistently describe stabbing Carey in the heart and the stomach. Those are vital organs.
You say consistently, your adversary pointed out discrepancies. Could you address the extent of the discrepancies in the emails?
Yes, Your Honor. There are discrepancies such as the day of the week that this occurred, time of day, month, those kinds of, there are some discrepancies within the emails. However, they consistently describe a stabbing death. And so they're consistent in the most important details that this was a stabbing death. This is similar to State versus Escamilla, where this court looked at evidence that a gun was placed execution style against the head of the defendant, say that shows premeditation. His premeditation may be only in an instant, and this shows, this manner of stabbing death shows premeditation. In addition, there's, in part of the cover-up, page 2221 of the Bill of Exceptions, cites to one of the exhibits, I don't have the exhibit number, but in these cover-up, one of the imposter emails had a photograph of Carey's driver's license and a knife attached to it. Now, we don't have anything physical to say that this was the murder knife, but it's evidence that it could be, that Shanna had held on to this knife, that she used it in her cover-up. But ultimately, any inconsistencies in the email go to the credibility, not to, these are her own words. They describe the manner of killing, and it's premeditated, and therefore, on appeal, that's sufficient to show premeditation. To answer a quick question from earlier about the blood stain on the car, after the murder emails came out, the police reprocessed this car to see if they could find any blood or anything corroborating the account of the death in the emails. And at that time, they removed the seat cover, which had been recently cleaned. It was a cloth seat cover. When the car was initially processed, the seat cover had been recently cleaned. You could see a bit of a pinkish tinge on the passenger seat cover, and that's visible in the photographs that are in evidence, but they hadn't initially tested it for blood, or it may not have tested positive for blood, it had been recently cleaned. But when they removed the seat cover, they found what's described as a large red stain, uncovered and soaked to the foam of the passenger seat. That's on page 1513 of the Bill of Exceptions. The description is a large red stain. The opposing counsel is correct that we don't know whether this is sufficient blood to prove that a person died, but given all of the other evidence in the record, this also corroborates the emails and the account of death contained in them. Additionally, Gallier's fingerprints were discovered in the car. And so this is a very condensed summary of the extensive circumstantial evidence in this case. However,
how is this case different, for example, than the Washington case that opposing counsel cited? What is the sort of status of cases out there that we might look at?
And Your Honor, I'm mixing up in my head the Washington case and the Florida case that were cited by the defendant. In one of them, there was a distinction because the defendant testified, and so the evidence was distinct. There were actual innocent explanations offered by the defendant that were uncontroverted. The Washington case, if I'm recalling the case correctly, I believe the biggest distinction is that here we have the confession emails that are a confession in the own voice of the defendant, and that's enough to establish premeditation. It's enough to support that conviction in the light most favorable to the state. For these reasons, the state asks this court to affirm the judgment of the district court with respect to the murder. Turning to Gallier's sufficiency argument relating to the arson, Gallier also argues that the evidence was insufficient to support her arson conviction. She doesn't argue with the findings of the fire marshal that her home was intentionally set on fire. She simply argues that the evidence was insufficient to show that she set the fire. However, the state disagrees. Evidence in the record shows that in August 2017, Gallier and Dave had once again broken up, and Gallier was being evicted from her home for failure to pay electric bills in violation of her lease. On August 17th at 8:24 a.m., Gallier called 911 and reported a fire at her residence. However, approximately 8 hours earlier, some of these imposter accounts controlled by Gallier had sent emails to Dave saying that Gallier's home was being burned. And so the timing of these emails showed that Gallier knew about the fire before she reported it to 911, and that's evidence that she set the fire as part of this cover-up. Turning briefly to Gallier's ineffective assistance of counsel claims, Gallier's brief makes 7 claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. The state submits that 2 of them cannot be decided on direct appeal. And as the state argued in its brief, the remaining 5 claims are either insufficiently stated or refuted by the record. The only argument that I'd like to change a bit from my brief is the argument that counsel was ineffective in stipulating to the admission of evidence. There were 44 pieces of evidence in the stipulation, and so although I go into the merits somewhat in my brief, I'd also like to argue that simply claiming that counsel was ineffective in failing to stipulate was insufficient to preserve this, because there are 44 pieces of evidence, and counsel doesn't indicate specifically which pieces were inadmissible or why they were inadmissible. For that reason, I'd say you could also dispose of that claim by saying that it was insufficiently raised. But because this is a direct appeal, I'd be comfortable submitting the remaining ineffective claims on brief unless there are any questions. The state would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute, 52 seconds.
1 minute and 52 seconds, Ms. Hotcher.
Thank you, Your Honor. In their argument, the state claims that these confession emails provide evidence of intent and malice. However, at best, these emails, all the emails provide is that a stabbing probably occurred. The emails do not give any context about how that stabbing occurred, why that stabbing occurred, the author's thought process surrounding that stabbing. Again, we have this gap. Attempting to fill that gap with a series of emails that are internally inconsistent, and it's more than just the day of the week. It is about how that stabbing occurred and how the body was disposed of. Key details, if the state is hanging their hat of first-degree murder on these emails, we have to be honest with how inconsistent they are and how that causes problems. We don't know exactly when this stabbing occurred, the nature of those injuries. Even the emails do not provide that evidence. The problem is that we don't even have circumstantial evidence here of intent or malice. We just don't know how this murder occurred, assuming the murder happened. This is different from the case in Escamilla. I believe, as opposing counsel stated, in Escamilla, there was evidence that the defendant held a gun to the victim's head. We don't even have that here. We don't have, even in the emails don't mention threatening Ms. Farver with the knife. We don't know what happened prior, even in the emails, we don't know what the emails claim happened prior to the stabbing. We just don't know anything about this murder. Again, similar to how the Court of Appeals ruled in Washington v. Hummel, all of this may be evidence that Shanna Gallier is guilty of something, but we don't know what that something is. We have this big gap in the timeline, and that is when any premeditation would have occurred, and we don't know what happened there. Even taking evidence in light most favorable to the state, there just is nothing of that evidence. For that reason, and because the state presented insufficient evidence of arson in the second degree and ineffective assistance, and Ms. Gallier received ineffective assistance of counsel, I request this court reverse the district court's convictions. If there's no further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, arguments for the day are concluded. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.